Good afternoon and welcome to the podcast series, Exploring Extremism. It's a four-episode spin-off series developed by UNDP in collaboration with the Oslo Governance Center. The podcast is based on the emerging findings from the second iteration of the Journey to Extremism flagship report. Based on a signature data set of more than 2,000 respondents across eight African countries, this report seeks to unpack why a handful of individuals took the final decision to join violent extremist groups when others did not, and to further expand on our understanding of the drivers that shape individuals' decision to leave these groups behind. Each month, we will dive into specific cross-cutting thematic areas emanating from the data set of this new study and discussing this with leading experts in the field, ahead of the launch of the global report by the end of this year. Today, I'm your host. My name is Chukwuma Ume, Project Manager on Preventing Violent Extremism of the Governance, Peace and Security Unit of UNDP Nigeria Country Office. For this episode, we would look into the issue of the use of drugs as pathway to violent extremism, looking into the sub-region of Lake Chad, especially. Today, drug abuse has become a threat that poses a significant challenge to the physical and mental well-being of societies. Territories with a history of state neglect, low service delivery, limited cross-border management and control, and different sources of tensions represent havens not only for drug traffickers, but also for violent extremist groups. This is evident in the sub-region of Lake Chad, where insurgent groups such as Boko Haram dominate. Yet, notwithstanding the severity of this issue, the relationship between drug use and violent extremism in West Africa and in the Lake Chad sub-region particularly have not been well researched, and its implications for preventing and countering violent extremism have not been properly examined in depth, although we do know there's a link between them. Today, we have a few guest speakers with us who are experts in this field, who will help us dive into this pertinent issue and help us to deepen our understanding of the intersections between the use of drugs and violent extremism. So let me begin by introducing my guests. Have Mr. Tom Parker, who is an experienced counterterrorism practitioner with UNODC in Nigeria, and the author of Avoiding the Terrorist Trap, Why Respect for Human Rights is the Key to Defeating Terrorism. Welcome, sir.
Thank you.
We also have with us Ms. Hawa Shafi Nuhu, a lawyer, essayist, and reporter with bylines in several international publications, currently working as a specialized reporter at Home Angle, covering underreported layers of terrorism in North Central Nigeria. You're welcome, ma.
Thank you.
And finally, we have Mr. Mustafa Al-Hassan, Program Manager in Global Conflict Response and Prevention with NIM Foundation. NIM Foundation is a leading crisis response organization in West Africa. We are happy to note that NIM has been playing a leading role in supporting data collection for the Journey to Extremism study in the Lake Chad region, both for the first and the second iteration of this report. Ladies and gentlemen, I would sincerely want to welcome all of you for joining us here today.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
So firstly, we'll start by exploring the broader relationship between drug use and violent extremism. So let me start with you, Mr. Tom. looking into the context of Nigeria and Lake Chad more broadly, what are the key factors responsible for the growing use of drugs in communities, and how is this issue linked to violent extremism?
I think there's actually quite a lot to unpack here. Insurgencies, terrorist organizations, they don't fall out of the sky. People join terrorist organizations for a variety of really, really complex reasons. And a lot of the research that's been conducted on radicalization suggests that there are multiple pathways to joining an insurgent or terrorist group, and indeed, every person's journey is unique. Can drug use play a part in a person's decision to join a terrorist group, or perhaps more relevantly, stay in a terrorist group? Yes, it's possible, but it's unlikely ever to be the only reason. And certainly when we're thinking about why people join terrorist groups, drug use I don't think would be a major factor. You're more likely to see marginalization, an experience of hostile state action, but also perhaps somewhat relevant in the context of drug use, social connections to other people who are already in the group. And in that kind of context, we would see, for example, drug use is often something that comes out of social connections. You know somebody who's already using drugs who introduces you to it. In certain respects, violent extremism is a little bit like that. You could be introduced into a group by somebody who's already within the group. So there, I guess, are some parallels. But I think in this context, the real relevance is more about social control, that once somebody is in the group, whether they have volunteered or, as is often the context in with the example of Boko Haram and its affiliates, as it were, what we have is more a case of people being suborned, people being sort of forcibly conscripted into Boko Haram. And in those circumstances, we do know that there is a lot of drug use within the group, or at least we know a lot of people who've come out of the groups do seem to have a need for drug treatment. That suggests that drugs are being used by JAS and ISWAP, and particularly JAS, I think, as a means of social control, particularly with younger fighters or younger members of the group, as a way to make them dependent on commanders. So it's definitely part of the mix. It's definitely something that's going on, but in terms of drivers of extremism, it's perhaps one factor, but probably not the main factor as to why people actually get involved in the first place.
Thank you very much, Mr. Tom. And Mustafa, if I could come to you. From the process of collecting data for the Journey to Extremism, Boot 1 and 2, could you further expand on this point?
Thank you very much. I'd like to provide some bit of historical context. Over the years, alcohol and drug abuse have largely been linked to human violent behavior across board. However, there's hardly been any significant research that points to this up until very recent time. In work that we've done across the Journey to Extremism research, for instance, we had seen close to an over 80% increase in the number of people who had used drugs after joining the group. With the insurgency group lasting for over a decade, they've basically been able to metamorphose and change tactics. And while they've used this to raise funds, they've also been able to utilize drugs to improve courage for their members or to eliminate fear or anxiety, even in some cases, so that people can perpetrate some of the crimes. And to also enhance operational capacities for many of their members just before a raid or an attack. It's been documented over and again where we've spoken directly to many of the commanders as well as people perpetrating acts that drugs were being distributed to them before an attack was imminent.
Thank you so much, Mustafa. Moving on from you, I would now want to bring in Hawa to help us to get a sense of the journeys in the northeastern Nigeria. And from working with abductees and recruits in Boko Haram, could you please help us draw a much more personalized account of the issue?
Okay, thank you for having me. So the issue of drug use amongst terrorist or insurgent groups across the north of Nigeria is quite complex. Terror groups, especially the BH, the Boko Haram, insist that they are Muslim, and at the core of Islam, drug use is completely prohibited. It is haram. And so right from the onset of the terror group, it was treated like that within them. And so it was even punished sometimes with death. And so, but of course, this did not mean that it would stop the insurgents from using the drugs, right? And so you would find cases where they would have to hide in order to use the drugs. And so I remember I once spoke with a woman who told me that her husband would have these bottles of penta and give it to her, and he would ask her to dig the ground as deep as she can go and then hide them, because, you know, throwing them away would not even, he did not even feel safe enough. And then there were cases also where she could threaten him, mm-hmm. saying that she could report his drug use to the terror group's leadership if she wanted reprieve from something that he was doing or something. And there were cases also where when women used this threat against their terrorist husbands, the husbands would just divorce them. They would say stuff like, oh, since you want to destroy my life, you can just leave. It's no longer the case, because before, where you could see that the group's leadership would execute members for the use of drug, over time, the group has evolved into seeing the use of drug as some sort of necessity. There is a doctrine in Islam called the doctrine of daman, the doctrine of necessity, where things that are expressly prohibited would sometimes be permitted to be done. And so the terror group began to see drug as something that was very useful for them in order to execute the work, in quotes, that they do. And so, you know, for them to be able to do all of the violent things that they're doing, sometimes they feel like they need these drugs in order to be able to power through, you know, especially when they're having face-offs with members of the Nigerian army. And so there were cases that there were instances where they could find a man who had abused drugs, but the excuse that he would give would be that he needed it for the work that he was doing, which is the work of God. And so it was increasingly becoming difficult for them to be able to adequately execute people who were using drugs. They also had these ideological differences within them. And so you could still be punished for drug use if they felt like your convictions were not radical enough for them. And also if you're an Awam, you know, amongst them they have the Awam and then they have the Rijal. The Awam are people who are amongst the terror groups but who are not really violent. They are just, say, farmers, traders. They don't really necessarily take up arms. Mm. And so for people like that, it's easy for them to question their ideological beliefs and convictions. And so if people like that are caught using drugs, they are more likely to be executed, especially now that we've seen a lot of cases of the Awam being victimized and ostracized. And so really it also has to do with the ideological convictions, who is taking the drug, why they're taking the drug, why they say they are taking the drug, and how did it come to light that they are taking the drugs. And so from my conversations with a lot of these people, I see that the things that they use the most are tramadol, pentazocine, cigarettes, and all of that, because they feel like it is necessary for their work.
Can you please tell us, from the work you've done in the past, documenting the lives of women abducted during the early years of the Boko Haram insurgency in the country, women who have ended up becoming wives of insurgents, what are the gendered implications of drug abuse in insurgency groups like Boko Haram? I mean, drawing from your interactions with these women.
I'm glad that you asked this question, because I think oftentimes the larger or broader conversations around drug abuse does not always include women, and women are an indisposable part of all of these conversations. So, like I said before, sometimes when the insurgents use this drug, but sometimes it also to enhance the sexual activities that they have with their wives. I've spoken with women who have said that the sexual activities they had with their insurgent husbands who engaged with the use of drugs was so violent that it gave them health complications. I remember a particular woman talking about suffering a uterine prolapse. It's a medical term for when the uterus inside you sort of moves out of place and begins to protrude out of you. Sometimes it needs to be pushed back into place manually. So it feels as gruesome and violent as it sounds, right? So these are really some of the ways that it affects the women. And I remember also she talked about the fact that one day, whenever her husband was taking the pills, she would ask him, what are those pills for? And he would say, oh, they are just painkillers. And so one day she said that she wanted it for herself because she was experiencing a lot of pain. And he said no, that she would run mad if she took them. And so from then she started to realize that, oh, these are really not just painkillers, these are actually hard drugs. So, but then she also got tempted to use them herself. So there are lots of other cases of women who see their husbands engaging in these things and who want to engage in these things because they feel like it might help alleviate the suffering or the pain that they're going through. Drug abuse also, it's not just an instrument of, you know, improving the operational capacities of these people, even though it is, of course, a very important part. It's also sometimes just a consequence of poverty, really. It's just, you know, some people use it because they're hungry and they don't have food. Some people use it because it's cold and, you know, it's flooding, it's raining, and it's just flooding into their tents and they are cold and all of that. So, yes, women get affected by this in very broad ways. A lot of the women also said even now that they have escaped captivity, they still have health complications that were as a result of the things that they suffered in the hands of men who had used hard drugs.
Thank you very much, Hawa. And once again, I want to thank all of us. Mustafa, you want to come in?
Yeah, I just wanted to add that from our research, Hawa did point out women being victims of the use of drugs, but also from our research also, we were able to see that a significant proportion, about 38% of the respondents that we spoke to said that women had basically been involved in the use of drugs also. So whether be it as enhancers, as she had mentioned, or for coping mechanisms, amongst many other things. When you disaggregate the data, you see that even when it comes to the gendered issues, for instance, and the use of drugs, bringing home the conversation, the use of drug, for instance, in our own research, what we saw was there's a significant use here in Nigeria compared to places like Cameroon or Niger or Chad. But then when you begin to look again, you begin to see that the use of drugs, for instance, in places like Chad for women, amongst other places, there's a likelihood that is by far much more high. So I just wanted to add that women have been on the receiving end. There's a broad conversation also on the role of women and how women have contributed also or contribute to organized crime or terrorism in this case. So I just wanted to add that.
Yes, I'm also very glad that you add that, because often when we talk of women and think of women, we think of women as mostly victims, but women are perpetrators. Women have been perpetrators. I've spoken with women who admitted to having prepared girls to go as suicide bombers. I've spoken with women who have told me that they think that the BH, the Boko Haram that was terrorizing and bombing cities in 2014 and 2015 were the ones doing the work of God. These are deeply radicalized women. And another part of the conversation is the fact that we don't necessarily have the structure or systems in place that could help de-radicalize these women after they have defected from these terror groups. I feel like that's like another topic for another podcast. But yeah, it's a really important part of the conversation. Really. Absolutely. Yeah.
Moving away from exploring drugs as a pathway into violent extremism, there's also ample evidence that drug is a viable pathway for extremist group to fund their activities. Tom, please let me come back to you again. As a representative of UNODC, which is a leading organization working on countering drug and illicit crime, among others, could you please tell us what is the relationship between illicit crime, drug trafficking, and violent extremist activity? I mean, taking into cognizance the sub-region of the Lake Chad. Could you help further unpack why violent extremist groups find the use of drugs important in their operations?
I think that's a good question as well. And I think we also have to ask ourselves whether it is a strategic intent or simply a situational development. Armed groups tend to occupy often in the same kind of unpoliced spaces that criminal groups also operate in. So it's quite natural that you would see a convergence of interests between different criminal elements, one being the armed group, the other being the organized crime or drug trafficking group, coming together where there are areas of mutual interest. Obviously, there's a lot of money in drug trafficking. I don't know that there's any evidence of Boko Haram being involved in drug trafficking directly. What one sees in a lot of conflicts is armed groups taxing criminal elements operating in territory they control. We certainly have seen armed groups in other parts of the world benefiting from the narco trade. I'm thinking particularly of areas in Latin America. Colombia would be perhaps the classic example of a nexus between terrorism and narcotics trafficking. But I don't know that we've seen a huge amount of evidence of that sort of symbiotic relationship necessarily here in Nigeria, which is not to say that it doesn't exist. It's just that I don't know that there's that much evidence of it at the moment. But at the end of the day, armed groups, they need revenue sources. And in an area like northeast Nigeria, there aren't a lot of revenue sources. And so Boko Haram are reduced to essentially extorting money from communities by tax, whether it's on fishing or crops or cattle, but also on illegal activity. It is somewhat inevitable that relationships will develop. We've also seen a suggestion of connections between Boko Haram and kidnappers, for example. And there's a suggestion that there might be some financial gain from the wave of kidnappings that have hit Nigeria in the last year or so between criminal gangs and armed groups. So this is very murky, and a lot of the information that has been sort of reported upon essentially as rumor. There's not a great deal of hard evidence. There's a little bit of research done on this, but not a whole hell of a lot. But again, it's logical to find armed groups and criminal gangs finding things in common, particularly in ungoverned spaces, of which there are a lot in northern Nigeria.
Thank you very much. Hawa, maybe I could also quickly come to you on the same question.
Yeah.
As someone who's on the ground and has really engaged with members of the community. So what do you think? How do they use these drugs as pathway to fund their activities and operations?
Right. So I think it's a really deep issue, particularly if we want to talk about, you know, the ways that they get these drugs ferried across to them. But what I have seen or have known from speaking with people is that oftentimes it's ferried to them in the same way that arms and ammunitions are being ferried to them. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they make these things locally themselves, say with homemade bombs or servicing guns and all of that. But there are also times when they have these weapons being ferried to them, especially across places like Damboa into Sambisa Forest. And so it's mostly being ferried through to them through water bodies with ammunitions, through people who are even positioned within the actual state-controlled territories and not just in ungoverned spaces. So the fact that not all of the group is domiciled in Sambisa Forest or all of these ungoverned spaces also facilitates, you know, the financial implications of the use of these drugs. For example, Human Angle has done a lot of reporting on how the leadership of ISWAP has been increasingly moving away from ungoverned spaces into state-controlled areas. There was a case where, for example, one terror member was apprehended in Kano State. He had been living there and just amassing properties and doing strategic work there for like a year or two before he was finally nabbed by the police. And so what we've seen recently is increasing cases of members of the terror group, especially top members of these terror groups, now being domiciled in state-controlled areas, of course, in disguise. But what this means is that it has the potential to facilitate the linkage between the drug use and then the financial reinforcement that they are getting, because they are no longer shut away from civilization. They are now positioned in areas where a lot of these things can now be facilitated.
Thank you so much, Hawa. Mustafa, drawing specifically from the Journey to Extremism brief, could you also please elaborate on the way violent extremist groups use funds, you know, to fund the activities and operations?
Okay, very similar to what Tom and Hawa have said, is that we've basically been able to see that it is a significant method for funding the activities. Also, one thing that I just wanted to add, pretty much, is the fact that there's what our research showed is that there's also almost like a bartering system, a trade bartering system, where there's almost exchange for weapons, amongst other things, with the use of drugs. That's something that has been established through the research. Having said that, it's also important to see that they do see the use of drugs, yes, to finance terrorist activities, but equally as something that is a useful, almost like a useful commodity that they could use to exchange to get weapons.
Thank you so much. It's been wonderful so far. But now we want to shift attention towards the solutions. So let me ask you, Tom, please, if I may. What does this issue of substance and drug pose of challenges for the field of preventing and countering violent extremism? And how is this being addressed by your organization and at large?
Obviously, Nigeria at the moment is facing a number of challenges. And one of the very significant challenges at the moment is the rise of criminal activity of various types across the country, but particularly kidnapping. And there are many causes for that, and there are many consequences that come from that. We know that poor governance is a driver of extremism, for example. So if we have a rise of criminal activity, that is likely to cause greater stress in society and might push more people into opposition with the state. We also know that poor capacity on the part of government will encourage people to enter criminal activity. Most criminal activity is basically transactional. There's a whole body of criminological research that suggests that people basically enter into crime as a cost-benefit analysis. They look at the benefits gained against the risks taken if they enter into criminal activity. If the risks are low and the benefits are high, more people are likely, as rational actors, to entertain the idea of becoming involved in criminal activity. And at the moment, the Nigerian police force is massively overstretched and has very little capacity to effectively investigate the tide of crime that currently that it's facing. And that presents lots and lots of challenges. It also pulls resources away from the counterterrorism effort, for example. So there is this weird sort of cause and effect or feedback loop almost that's going on. And the worse criminal activity becomes, the more consequences there likely are to be for the overall security situation in the country. As an organization, one of the things UNODC is trying to do to reverse that is to build the capacity of Nigerian law enforcement entities to respond to that threat. Mm. And we do a whole range of stuff. We do everything from training people on investigative techniques, forensic recovery, physical evidence collection, advice on policy, advice on legal instruments that might actually help the police operate more effectively. But fundamentally, no matter how much support is provided from the international community, this is a Nigerian problem. There is an initiative underway supported by the Nigerian government called the Porto that is looking at police reform. And I actually had the opportunity, 2 days ago, I was in the big meeting of the Porto. One of the leading lights of the Porto actually described the criminal, the breakdown of law and order as an existential threat, which I thought was very striking. Only the government of Nigeria really can address that threat. At the end of the day, the real effort has to come from within, with allies and supporters contributing from the sidelines. And I think, going forward, it's really encouraging to see the government is trying hard to address this challenge.
So now, let me come to you, Mustafa, before we would invite Howard to also come in as we begin to wrap up. What do you think civil society organizations, Mustafa, practitioners and communities could do to militate against the use of drugs across communities at risk or affected by violent extremism?
Thank you very much, Chukwuma. I think there's a broad range of solutions. I don't think it's just an issue that's limited only to CSOs. I think we have to begin to reimagine the kinds of solutions that we have to many of the multidimensional and multisectoral problems we have in Nigeria, and drugs is one of them. I normally would recommend education, for instance, as a good way. Usually across the board, you find, irrespective of any country in the world, drug use is something that is usually teenagers are introduced to drug use at a certain stage. So the kind of education that we provide that basically works towards improving critical thinking, logical reasoning, and an education that is value-based also is very important. And that's something for us, NIM, we've been able to do significantly by carrying out different campaigns across board, but equally providing opportunities in education, training teachers, thousands of teachers in the Northeast, and equally providing direct education to many children so that they understand from a very young age the consequences of drug use, and in the long term that also contributes to militating against terrorist recruitment amongst many other issues. Having said that, I think you can't really contribute to a solution to a problem if you do not understand the entirety of that problem. So it's important for us to do and commission a lot more additional research on the intersections and interlinkages between drug use, drug abuse, and violent extremism. And we might be very much surprised at some of the outcomes or some of the things that we even find is the use of drug or drug abuse is connected with many other issues. You know, what are the intersections between drugs and corruption, for instance, right? So there are many layers that we can begin to unpack. Lastly is supporting people who have used drugs by providing them mental health and psychological support, which is something that at NIM we're at the forefront of doing, and we've been able to train a multitude of counselors across the world to contribute towards providing counseling services, be it individual or personal, to victims or of the violent extremism, either in the Northeast or in the Lake Chad region, as well as other parts of the world. But it's incredibly important to be able to provide services that, be it in cases where people use drugs for coping strategies, or in cases where they were farmers and they were had interacted with the groups either in any capacity or so, it's important for us to be able to mainstream mental health support as well as psychological interventions across interventions that we provide.
Thank you very much, Mustafa. Let me also quickly bring in Hawa to provide us with some reflections, recommendations, and as well draw lessons that probably have learned in the course of this conversation or your work experience in the community.
I feel like I'm just going to do the totally Nigerian thing and say Mustafa has said it all. He has basically covered everything that I feel like he's covered, the mental health aspects, the developmental aspects, the fact that it's not just civil organizations who have a duty for all of this, the fact that to solve a problem, you need to understand the problem. And so I'm just going to add that I think it's also important that organizations who are at the forefront of trying to solve these issues should take the work of journalists and researchers very seriously. These are the people who directly interface with people who are most affected by these issues. And so if you take the jobs of the works of journalists and researchers seriously, it gives you an uncommon advantage. You get to understand the problem, which then empowers you enough to attempt to solve the problem. And so it's also to talk about the way that organizations and the society at large really treats people who struggle with drug abuse or who have struggled with drug abuse before, and the current ways that Nigeria is solving the issue. I'm currently doing an investigation into an institute here in the north of Nigeria that says that it's treating drug users of drug. But the people that I've spoken with who have passed through the system have really horrible stories of how they were treated. And the organization really believes that it is actually treating drug abuse. And so we need to rethink our approach to treating drug abuse? Are we treating drug abuse in a violent way? Are we doing it in a way that is empowering, in a way that looks at the full humanity of these people? Are we centering their human rights? The answer is no, we're not. So we need to devise ways that acknowledge that these are humans with full agency. These are humans that have gone through these things and who need help, not humans to be treated like animals.
Thank you very much, Hawa, for further unpacking even the earlier submissions from Mustafa. So we all agree that education is key. Training and strengthening capacity of law enforcement agencies is also very strategic. We also agree that providing mental, psychosocial support is also very relevant in the course of our work. So, can't thank you enough for these very useful submissions. And I would like to say this brings us to the end of this episode. We can't thank you enough. A special thanks go to our guest speakers, Mr. Tom Parker, Counterterrorism Project Coordinator, UNODC, Nigeria, Hawa Shafi Nuhu, their journalist from Home Angle, and Mustafa Al-San, Program Manager, NIM Foundation. Thank you all for joining us today and providing the rich insights and perspective on today's topic, which is drugs, a pathway to extremism. Also, special thanks to NIM Foundation for their support in putting this together. As always, thanks for listening to Exploring Extremist podcast. Stay tuned for the next episode that will be launched next month.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.